I hear that it was passed by well-intentioned moral people who just wanted to save the rest of us from the temptation of alcohol. Of course, it failed because sobriety can come only from the inside. You can't force people to be sober or honest or kind, and they'll do it anyway. You can say thou shalt not till you're blue in the face, and they'll do it anyway. The best way, the only effective way, is to serve as an example and not to impose your will. I used to try to make my children moral by telling them what they should do, what they shouldn't do, what they should like, what they shouldn't like. In my confusion, I was trying to be a good mother, and I thought that this was the way to make them good people. When they didn't do what I wanted, I would shame or punish them, believing that it was for their own good. So in reality, what I taught them was to break my laws and be very careful not to get caught. I taught them that the way to have peace in our home was to sneak and lie. Many of the things I was teaching them not to do, I had done myself and hadn't admitted to them, and some of the things I was still doing, even as they watched. I expected them not to do these things simply because I said so. It didn't work. It was a recipe for confusion. I lost my children 20 years ago. I came to see that they were never mine to begin with. That was an extreme loss. They truly died to me. I discovered that who I thought they were had never existed at all. And my experience of them now is more intimate than I can describe. Today, when my children ask me what they should do, I say, "I don't know, honey." Or, "Here's what I did in a similar situation, and it worked for me. And you can always know that I'm here to listen, and that I'm always going to love you, whatever decision you make." You'll know what to do. And also, sweetheart, you can't do it wrong. I promise you that. I finally learned to tell my children the truth. It's painful to think you know what's best for your children. It's hopeless. When you think that you need to protect them, you're teaching anxiety and dependence. But when you question your mind and learn how not to be mentally in your children's business, finally there's an example in the house. Someone who knows how to live a happy life. They notice that you have your act together and that you're happy, and so they start to follow. You have taught them everything they know about anxiety and dependence, and now they begin to learn something else, something about what freedom looks like. That's what happened with my children. They just don't see a lot of problems anymore, because in the presence of someone who doesn't have a problem, they can't hold on to one. If your happiness depends on your children being happy, that makes them your hostages. I think I'll just skip them and be happy from here. That's a lot saner. It's called unconditional love. Why would I give my children advice when I can't possibly know what's best for them? If what they do brings them happiness, that's what I want. If it brings them unhappiness, that's what I want. Because they learn from that what I could never teach them. I celebrate the way of it, and they trust that, and I trust it.
She has no destination in view and makes use of anything life happens to bring her way.
When you have no destination in view, you can go anywhere. You realize that whatever life brings you is good, so you look forward to it all. There's no such thing as adversity. Adversity is just an unquestioned thought. Without a belief, there's no separation. Adversity and good fortune are equal. You can wake up on Mars, you can find yourself in hell, and there's no problem because the work is alive inside you. You can flip into the most unusual mind states, into emotions that you've been hiding from yourself for decades. You can enter the worst of your fears, and with inquiry, it doesn't matter where you go or how you appear. Without a belief, you are all things. And if you get stuck in a particular identity, you have inquiry to unstick you. One day in 1986, as I was walking in a shopping mall, I saw a very old woman coming toward me on a walker. She looked like she was in her 90s. Her back was bent and her face grimaced from what appeared to be pain. As I continued to walk, I noticed to my horror that I was looking out through this old woman's eyes at the woman I had been, the one with Katie's body, so healthy, agile, and as bright as all the lights in the world. As I watched her, the bright one began to round the corner in her usual fast-paced, carefree manner, and I realized that I was now the old woman. I felt her pain. It wasn't hers now, but mine. I smelled my putrid odor. I became aware of my body's flesh disconnected and hanging from its bones. The flesh was wrinkled and gray with no muscles to hold it. The pain shot through my joints with each movement. The slowness of my motion felt unbearable. The thought that accompanied the feeling was, I want to move as fast as that young woman. It's not fair. And then the full horror of the situation appeared. If I were to give it words, the thought would be, oh my God, I'm trapped here. I'm supposed to be the young bright one. There's been a mistake. I'll never get out. I'll be like this forever. Immediately inquiry arose, I am this. Is it true? Is it true that I am this forever? How do I react when I believe that thought? What would I be without the thought? The questioning, too, was beyond words. It didn't come after the wordless thought. Thought and questions arose at the same instant and canceled each other out. The horror was equivalent to a deep gentleness, a caressing, a full, immovable acceptance. There was no discomfort. It began from its new position to celebrate the whole life of itself, to love itself as the old woman, and to appreciate the slow pace, the withered flesh, the pain, the stench. The stench was as sweet as the fragrance of spring. I was able to love that it had found the perfect home for a me. There was no longer